welcome to the Delling Pod with me, James Dellingpole. And I know I always say I'm excited about this week's special guest, but before we introduce him, let's have a word from one of our superb sponsors. I don't know whether you've noticed, but the gold price has been getting quite interesting recently. But it's not too late to get in. I think it's very important to have holdings in gold and silver. And there are two main ways of doing this. Either you have physical metal, either delivered to your doorstep or in a vault in Switzerland or London, in which case I recommend the Pure Gold Company, and you'll find the details below. But if you want to earn interest on your gold, so you don't pay the costs of storing your gold, for example, and you don't incur the risks of having to hide it at home, I recommend a company called Monetary Metals. Now, it's extraordinary that they've worked out a way of paying interest on gold, but they do it. They do it by lending out gold to the jewellery industry and similar industries, and they pay you your interest in the form of further gold. I've had the CEO, Keith Wiener, twice on my podcast, and I like the product. I use it myself. You can get 2 to 5% annually in interest, 2 to 5% interest, or even more if you go for their higher yield gold bond offerings, if you're an accredited investor. It's a way of opting out of fiat currency and retaking control of your money. So go to monetary-metals.com/Dellingpole. I'll put the details below this and open an accredited account. Welcome to the Delling Pod, Captain Dan Hanley, retired. We're going to have that you're retired in a moment, not of your own choosing. Do you know, bizarrely, even though I've been doing podcasts for a long time, Dan, this is the first one I've ever done on 9/11. Because it's one of those things where I sort of went down the rabbit hole so rapidly that 9/11 became such a sort of obvious conspiracy that I sort of thought it didn't need dealing with. Because there were so many more obscure ones to examine. But I think it is about time we did 9/11. So tell me about the moment when you went from... I'm imagining you were a kind of regular guy, right. You know, ex-Navy pilot, commercial airline pilot, sort of pillar of the establishment system. What was it that kind of sent your spider senses... on alert and change you and kind of ruined your life and gave you the job that you're doing now?
Right. It's kind of a long story, but I'll try to cut it short. But the first thing I noticed were holes in the aviation security system. I had flight attendants and pilots who saw the same thing I did, because promises were made after 9/11 that they were going to have cameras in the back of the aircraft, federal air marshals, etc. And initially, none of that was... Well, they still don't have cameras in the back of the aircraft. But I got... When I tried to report it to my chief pilot and above, I got this tremendous blowback telling me, keep your head down. These guys are nasty. If you take it to the next step, you're going to get hurt. And I went, what's this all about, right? So things got progressively worse because I persisted in pushing this issue. And they eventually... took me out of flight schedule because the union wouldn't represent me. And I was going to go non-pay, and I called my chief pilot and I go, this is punitive. I haven't done anything wrong. He goes, yeah, but you ruffled a lot of feathers in the top office. So he said to me, look, I ran into the chief flight surgeon out in Denver and they told me to put you on sick list. I go, what? I said, I haven't even seen an aeromedical professional. Well, he says, my hands are tied on this one. It came from up on top. So I knew at that point in time they were trying to get rid of me because I was exposing what a farce the aviation security system was. So
okay. So we better rewind slightly I want to look, tell me first of all about your flying career. So okay. You were a Navy pilot first?
Well, before that, I started at age 19 in 1968. 56 years ago, I'm showing my age, but I started out as a civilian, and I got my private commercial instrument multi engine rating, and then went into college and got a 4-year degree. And when I got out, Vietnam War was raging, so I chose naval aviation because I had the flight experience. And over the next 10 years, I flew a 4-engine turboprop called the P-3 Orion, which was used to track Soviet submarines during the Cold War. And in 1978, I got hired by United. And over the next 25 years, I flew 6 different aircraft. So all total, over a 35-year career span, I flew 15 different aircraft, accruing 20,000 flight hours. Now, I don't tell you that to boast on my flight resume, but to make the statement that with all my experience, I could not have flown the 9/11 flight profiles, and neither could the alleged Muslim hijackers because they were too...
Oh, yeah. We'll come to that in a moment. I just want to kind of establish you. So, did you serve in Vietnam?
No, I did not. I was tracking submarines in the Mediterranean and the North Atlantic.
Right. And so, what did that involve? Flying long missions? How does it work?
9 to 11 hours. And you actually went out, they had intelligence on where the submarines were, and you went out and dropped these sonar buoys that would pick up the aural signal coming off the submarine, and that's how we track them. So spent a lot of money doing it, a lot of time, and tracked a lot of submarines, but...
Yeah, so you were a Cold Warrior, and then you transferred to commercial airlines, and I would imagine that it was a pretty nice job to have. I mean, this was sort of the golden age of air travel before the security stuff came in. And
right.
Tell me about that a bit.
What about my experience before?
Yeah, was it fun? Was it a good life? Was it well paid?
Yeah, it was real good life, and it was being really well paid. I mean, I'll just tell you right up front that when I was terminated, I was making about $300,000 a year as a 777 captain out of New York. So I went from that to where I am right now because of what I did.
And I imagine you saw most places you wanted to see in the world.
Yes, I did. And I took my wife and kids with me. So it was
a great
time.
So it was a good life. What was your favorite place that you went to?
Anywhere in Europe. London.
Oh, okay.
The major capitals of Europe was really what I really enjoyed seeing because I'm somewhat of a history buff, and reading biographies, I like going to these places and reading about them before I went, so.
Ah, you see, I thought you were going to say somewhere like Bora Bora or Patagonia or somewhere obscure, but I suppose, because you see, for me, Europe's on my doorstep, so we get to see this stuff quite easily, whereas for you as an American, it must seem more exotic and kind of a bigger deal.
Right. So.
And so, okay. So, you went from having this amazing career. So anyway, we established you were living the dream, basically, right. Dan, and you had wife and kids who could come with you and stuff and benefit from all the perks of having an airline pilot as their dad. And then you lost everything as a result of 9/11. And you said at the beginning that the thing that first sort of got you into this was the regulations introduced in the wake of 9/11. I mean, are you saying that at the time you still believe the official narrative?
Well, I was
that it was caused by Muslim terrorists.
I was losing faith in the original narrative because some of the holes I saw in the security system, I thought to myself, if 9/11 really went down the way they said it did, they should be plugging up these holes. But really, James, it wasn't until they came out with the flying resume of the hijackers that I went, forget it. They couldn't have flown the airplane.
So when did they come out with the flying resume of the hijackers?
Because it's been over 20 years, I really can't remember. But I would guess it was around 2000, late 2002, early 2003, where they started saying what schools they went to, and they knew had a whole paper trail on their flying experience. And I couldn't believe, because I'd flown Cessnas in the late 60s, and then I flew the Boeing 757 and 767, and I knew they weren't qualified to fly those airplanes, and there's no way that they could have, having flown mainly in light single engine airplanes. It just doesn't work that way. So that's when I went, that's when I said the story is bunk, and it sent me down the road to where I am right now.
So I'm just trying to get the timeline, because we all of us remember where we were, I suspect, when those planes hit the Twin Towers. I remember being called from the lodger who lived in my basement at the time, sort of called me and said, something really weird is happening in New York. Come and have a look. And I think I saw the second plane, if it was a second plane, hit the second tower. And afterwards, probably like me, you would have been trawling the newspapers and the news for information about how this extraordinary event had happened, and you would have read lots of stuff up on it, and we all did. It was just kind of mystifying that this thing could happen on America, you know, the greatest, the worst assault on America since Pearl Harbor. This was the story we were given. So you would have been reading all this information. At the same time, you had your job as an airline pilot, and initially you were thinking about passenger safety. You'd be thinking of if there are more terrorist, if the world is swarming with terrorists trying to bring down airliners, we need to take this stuff seriously and take measures. And you're saying that the measures being taken were seemed to you insufficient, and that's what got you asking questions.
Exactly. All they did was reinforce the cockpit door. No cameras in the back. It took 2 years to get federal air marshals on my flights, and I was flying mainly New York to London. Okay, there was no secondary barrier protection in the back. They weren't screening 90% of the cargo for explosives. I could go on and on. I won't get into positive bag match and what that entailed, but they weren't doing that on domestic flights. So there were a number of things that they should have been or could have been doing and weren't doing, and that's what raised my eyebrows.
So you smelt a rat because you were thinking, if this problem is what they say it is, then why aren't they taking it seriously?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And then you started doing your, well, then you say that your suspicions were further aroused when you looked at the biographical information on the alleged the Muslim hijackers, most of whom supposedly came out of Saudi Arabia. And at that point you thought, well, I mean, you only need to explain this to a lot, to most people, even now, I imagine, watching this podcast will be thinking, well, obviously, after a few hours flight training, you can steer a commercial airliner into an enormous tower, because the tower's so big, and it's not like you've got to take off and land. You just got to crash it into something, and anyone could do that. I could do that. So maybe you can explain to me why it doesn't quite work like that.
Well, I wish I had my website up, because we have photos comparing Cessna 172 to Boeing 767, comparing the size of the aircraft, operating characteristics, etc. And we say it would be akin to having driven your car, family car, for about a year, and then trying to hop into a large semi-tractor trailer, an 18-wheeler, get it up to a real high speed, and try to drive it through a parking garage without scratching the sides of the truck. That's how difficult it would be.
Wow.
If you look at the tires, they're only 208 feet wide, and the wingspan on a 767 is 160 feet, so there's very little room for error, and yet all three planes struck their target, if you want to believe planes hit it, because some people don't, but all three planes hit their target with cruise missile precision on their first attempt. So
right.
You said the probability of that occurring is it's highly improbable that they did it. So,
right.
And if you go to the Pentagon hijacker, I'll get back to him later because I'd like to talk about a system. But if you go to the Pentagon hijacker, it's a more preposterous notion that he could have flown it into the Pentagon.
Well, isn't the Pentagon bigger than the Twin Towers?
Well, let me explain the maneuver he supposedly performed. American 77 took off from Washington Dulles, heading for the East Coast, West Coast, got to cruise altitude for a while, made a U-turn, and started a descent and got to 7,000 feet and commenced this 330-degree descending accelerating corkscrew turn to arrive precisely at the surface at over 500 knots without skidding the surface to precisely strike the Office of Naval Intelligence at ground level on his first attempt. Now you go, well, that doesn't sound too impossible. Well, this same maneuver was replicated in a simulator and flown by a group of pilot, very highly experienced pilots, and they crashed the simulator trying it, and yet we were led to believe that this Cessna pilot flew this and did it on his first attempt. But the story gets better than that, James. This same pilot went to the freeway airport in Maryland 1 month prior to 9/11 and was going to rent a 172, a little single-engine prop job. And he went up. When you show up at an airport, you got to go fly an evaluation flight to prove you can fly, right, before they rent it to you. Well, he didn't go up on one of them. He went up on three of them with two separate instructors. And they both reported to the chief flight instructor at the airport, a guy named Marcel Bernard, who I personally talked to and confirmed the story. And he refused to grant him permission to fly a 170, run a 172 from them. So what did Hanja do? He goes down the road to Congressional Air Charter, another fixed base operator, and went flying with a guy named Eddie Shalev. This is where the cover-up occurred by the government, because Eddie Shalev came back and said he was a good pilot. Now, the FBI and the 9/11 Commission staff interrogated these four pilots, the three at Freeway Airport and the one at Congressional Air Charter, okay? But not one mention was made of him being denied rental of the aircraft or these other pilots in the 9/11 Commission final report. As a matter of fact, the only mention made was an end note in the report that Eddie Shalev, and his name only appeared once, that he was a good pilot. So this is proof that both the FBI and the 9/11 Commission concealed this critical piece of information that Hanja couldn't fly.
What do we know about Eddie Shalev, the guy that gave the go-ahead to this?
He was an Israeli. He came to the States just prior to 9/11.
Oh, that's a coincidence, isn't it?
Yeah, right. Don't read anything into that.
No, nothing to see there.
He disappeared from the States. We suspect he went back to Israel. The question mark is, was he Mossad? Well, we can't prove that. But anyhow, that's the smoking gun of the three hijackers, that he couldn't fly a Cessna 1 month prior to 9/11.
Right. Okay. So your website, which we'll put the advert, we'll put the details at the bottom of this podcast. Tell me the name of your website.
9/11 Pilot Whistleblower.
Okay.
It's at 911pilot.org.
So you can go to that website, and I've been to the website, and it's, I mean, it focuses on your area of expertise, which is a very specific area of the 9/11 conspiracy theory, as I suppose normies would call it. You're focusing on the, because I mean, there are lots of other angles that one could approach it from, but yours is the alleged hijackers could not possibly have flown commercial airliners with their very limited experience into either the Twin Towers or the Pentagon. And it's obvious to you as a pilot that they could not have done this.
Yes, not just to me, but to other members of the organization, other pilots that we've interviewed.
And
on the website, there's a drop-down menu, and there's pilot interviews. You go to it. We just listed 10 of them because they were all saying the same thing that I did. That it was impossible, and they gave their reasons why they couldn't have flown the airplane.
Okay, so I've got to ask you, how many airline pilots are there? In fact, how many qualified pilots are there in the world? Do you know?
I've looked it up, and it's roughly 300,000 pilots.
Okay, so we're talking about and serving military pilots, and we're talking about commercial airline pilots and freight pilots and private pilots.
Right.
All of whom, most of whom, I imagine, because we were all curious, will have read up on the backgrounds of the hijackers and about their flying experience. So how is it that so few pilots have come forward and sort of signed up to your site?
They're afraid. Some of them we approach, because we went out to a large number of pilots, and some of them we approach, but get over it. It's 22 years ago. Let it go. You know, I said, no, we're never going to do that. But others would say, hey, I'm still working. I can't risk it if I speak out. So quite a few of the pilots we interviewed were retired pilots, and they were highly, highly qualified. We even had two Pakistan Air Force wing commanders who went on to become 747 captains at Pakistan International Airlines, who flew fighter jets, all kind of fighter jets, and said, there's no way. There's no way they could have done it. They said, we couldn't have done it. Maybe after several practice runs, we might have been able to hit the building, but not with that exact precision, because you got to look at the closure rate flying at over 500 knots. If you're a few degrees off heading, you're going to miss it. As a matter of fact, United 175 that hit the south tower, the second plane that hit, about 12 seconds out, the plane rolled into a 30-degree angle of bank turn, and had it not made that turn at precisely that time with that angle of bank, someone's computed that it would have missed the building entirely by 800 feet. So people that think you just point the airplane and go, it doesn't work that way.
Right. So all those 300,000-plus pilots, they know. I mean, they may not talk about it, but they must know, because is it that obvious?
It is, but then the question shows up, well, if not them, what? And that's all where we fill in the blank for what. And when they see what we're talking about, that was my aha moment in 2006 when I discovered the system from another pilot. And it was me saying, so that's how they did it, okay? And that's when, since 2006, the last 18 years, me and several pilots have been trying to broadcast this uninterruptible autopilot system to the world. And I appreciate you letting me come on, because we're using podcasts, social media, websites, or whatever we can to get the word out.
Yeah, I know that as you're probably aware, the world is full of infiltrators, pushing pretending to be on the side of truth and justice and infiltrating the narrative and leading people astray. I can tell that you are not one of them, that you're one of the good guys, because your profile is still pretty low. You've only got 67,000 followers, I think, on Twitter. You're not making like a bandit. Right. On the conspiracy circuit, you're just a kind of guy who lives in Islamabad with right. his wife.
Right. That's exactly right.
So, tell me about this. What really happened about how the planes were really guided?
The purpose of our organization, 9/11 Pilot Whistleblowers, is to show that they weren't controlling the aircraft, but that a system called the uninterruptible autopilot was employed that takes remote control of the aircraft's autopilot and flight management computer and flies it to its selected target. And once this system's engaged, the pilots can't disconnect it. And people will say, come on, you know, I'll lose your audience here. Well, people say, this guy's a whacked out conspiracy nut, saying these planes were remote controlled. But remote control technology goes back 80 years to 1944, when towards the end of World War II, the U.S. Army Air Corps in the U.K. actually gutted out old B-17 bombers to lighten the weight of the aircraft, and they load them up with 30,000 pounds of Torpex, which is a highly incendiary compound, and pilots were required to make the takeoff, but once they got airborne, they'd bail out of the airplane, and the airplane would be remotely guided to targets in Europe. Now, that was 80 years ago. As a matter of fact, Joe Kennedy's older brother, JFK's older brother Joe, was killed on one of these top secret missions when the plane blew up before he had a chance to bail out of the aircraft. And we got a film clip on the remote control page of the website that goes into that incident. But if you...
How many of these planes were flown, do we know?
We don't know.
But so this was from 1944. So they had, they had till April 1945 they're kind of flying bombs. The Germans had the V1s and V2s. So this is just a different delivery system.
Well, I believe the Germans were trying to create the same system. I'm not positive about them, but I thought I read it one time.
That is extraordinary that they had the technology in 1944 to remotely fly a plane as big as a B-17, which is,
Right.
those bombers we see on Masters of the Air, whatever it's called, the new Spielberg series.
Well, it gets better because we could cite a number of other examples, which we didn't, but we jump ahead to 1984, 40 years ahead of what I just talked about, where NASA and the FAA wanted to conduct a joint crash test experiment to test crew and passenger survivability in the event of a crash landing. In this case, they took a large four-engine Boeing 720 commercial jet aircraft, loaded it up with crash dummies and cameras, took it off remotely, flew it around the pattern several times before they intentionally crash landed. Now, this was 17 years before 9/11. And if you jump ahead to the early to mid-90s, and there's a Wikipedia article that will back up what we're saying here, but it's misleading because it says, it's called, if you Google Boeing Honeywell Uninterrupted Qualified, you get this chart Wikipedia article saying it existed, saying it does exactly what we claim, except it says that it was designed to prevent would-be hijackers from commandeering a commercial jet aircraft in flight and flying it to an airport for landing, okay? Well, they said it was patented in 2006. That's the misleading part. We have informants that have come forward who worked on the system or worked for Raytheon or other companies who have said, no, it was developed and produced in the mid-90s. So we're claiming there was a patent on this system. The system, the Wikipedia system, acknowledges that it existed. We know it was created before 9/11, and we say it's the only viable alternative explanation as to how those three jets hit buildings precisely, because people don't realize the advanced navigation system on today's modern commercial jet aircraft is derived from cruise missile technology. It's extremely accurate down to a couple meters once you have the computer program right the right way. So
So presumably, this has implications for a lot of mysterious aircraft disappearance stories, like the plane that in the Pacific. Where was it that?
Malaysia Air 370 took off of Kuala Lumpur heading for Beijing several years ago. And
Yeah.
it got up in the air, made a few erratic turns off course before it headed out over the Indian Ocean to disappear. Now, I'm talking with a guy that's done extensive research. His last name's Forbes, and I can't remember his first name, but you ought to interview him because he's got all the goods on this. I just got invited to be on an Australian radio program on Saturday to talk about this, but I said I don't have the in-depth knowledge to talk about it for an hour. But yeah, that's highly probable. I was invited on Malaysian TV a couple of years ago, on the anniversary date of the disappearance, to refute a British gentleman who was claiming the pilot committed suicide. So I had it 3 minutes, and they did a good job reporting on it, but that's widely believed what happened. And then you've got Malaysia Air 17, the plane that deviated off course and was shot down over the Ukraine. You've got the Russian Metro jet that went down in the Sinai, claiming that it was ISIS that planted a bomb on board the aircraft when the debris field was very, very restricted. It wasn't scattered over acres. It was in a very concise area, so indicating the plane wasn't blown up in the air because it would have looked like Lockerbie, Scotland, if that had happened. So there's a number of other airplane incidents that we claim is highly probable that this uninterruptible autopilot was used.
Right. And what do you think is the purpose? I mean, who is using this uninterruptible autopilot? Are we talking about Western intelligence services or what?
We don't know for sure, but we believe we can't prove this part, but we believe I did a Freedom of Information Act with the FAA on this, it yielded nothing. They said, we have nothing on the system, which is absurd because it was an avionics change for one thing, and they'd have to submit a change request with the FAA. But that leads us to believe that it was most probably a highly compartmentalized black project that involved Raytheon, Boeing, Honeywell, the Air Force, the FAA, all the military industrial complex. We believe they were all involved in the development and production of this product. And we don't know how many airplanes are on it, but I'll tell you this. When we bring pilots in to interview and we start talking, we don't coach them on what to say. I tell them what questions we're going to ask them. And then I explain this system to them. And they go, get out of here. That isn't on an airplane. We go, yeah, it's been on airplanes, but we don't know how many.
I have to say that's quite scary, because what it means is basically that they, whoever they are, right, can bring down any aircraft they want at any right time.
Right. I don't know if you saw it last year. I think it was last year. It was a China Eastern Flight 5735 en route to Beijing. From 29,000 feet, it took a vertical nosedive in two minutes to hit the surface. So much so that there were no body parts found anywhere. It exploded massively when it hit the surface. So we looked at that, me and another pilot, and said, it looks like the uninterruptible autopilot, because the reports were coming out, no known mechanical problem with the airplane, and there are indications that the pilots couldn't have interfered and the cockpit wasn't intruded. So I wrote, actually, the CEO of China Eastern, the Civil Aviation Agency of China, and even Xi Jinping, a letter, because we got a 66-page document on the uninterruptible autopilot system that particularly pertains to Malaysia 370. It's on our website. You can download it. And actually got in touch with a Chinese guy who was trying to make arrangements for me to get to Beijing and to Shanghai, but it was during the COVID season, and they had the two-week quarantine, and we kept putting it off until finally I didn't get over there. But I strongly suspect that that's the case.
Do you not worry, Dan, that they might get hold of your flight plans and just bring your airplane down?
Oh, yeah. I mean, since this system exists, let me tell you about the letters we wrote, okay? We decided, because there's another group of lawyers out there that were going the legal route up through the court system. They went up to the Supreme Court with their arguments about the Twin Towers being brought down by controlled demolition, okay? So we decided we were going to go the political route, approaching politicians and bureaucrats. And we started out with the FBI. Well, let me back up. We knew before we started this we were probably not going to get anywhere. But we did it anyhow, running the full gamut. And we went from the FAA to the administrator to the Secretary of Transportation, the Inspector General there. And then we went over to the Director of National Intelligence, Avril Haines, and even Biden, the Attorney General, Assistant Attorney General of Criminal Division, and the FBI Director, saying, hey, this system's on board an aircraft. We know it is. It's a hazard in aviation, and we suspect it was used on 9/11. Ordinary citizens shouldn't have to conduct investigations like this. Why don't you collaborate with the FAA, the Justice Department, with the FAA, and investigate our claim? And guess what kind of response we got? Nothing. Wouldn't return phone calls, emails, letters we wrote.
Yeah. And I see that you've put in your Twitter feed, I am not suicidal.
Yeah. Well, they kill people like me. Let me tell you about, you probably never heard of Philip Marshall, but he was a United Airlines Boeing 767 captain. He had written two books on 9/11 and was about to publish a third one. And he told his neighbors and his ex-wife, hey, I'm being threatened. And a few days later, his neighbors found his family dog and two teenage kids shot to death. And he had a bullet in the head. And the police ruled it a murder-suicide, that he had killed his kids and the dog and then shot himself. And guess who the California Attorney General was at the time that didn't investigate it? Tell me. Kamala Harris.
That is really creepy and freaky.
Yeah, yeah.
That is just horrible. I mean, have they threatened you?
No, but I get stopped by the FBI and TSA every time I come in and leave the States, and they know everything about me, and they know I'm here. I know I'm living amongst 240 million Muslims in Islamabad and Pakistan, saying there were no Muslim hijackers at the control. And the truth be told, James, this is a very poor country. It only costs about $50 to get somebody whacked over here. And it's crawling with every intelligence agency in the world because it's a political hotspot. So if they wanted to kill me, they would have done it by now. So,
yeah, I can see why you've got personal reasons for, I mean, apart from your sense of justice, that you're married to a Pakistani woman.
Right.
You live in Islamabad.
Right.
And one of the things I've seen you repeatedly mention is, look, that 9/11 was not the fault of the Muslims.
Right, right. That's our mantra. There were no Muslim hijackers controlling the airplane. So, I mean, we created flyers over here and distributed them at several cities. And I went down the street to a local mosque and people were getting out from prayers. And I started distributing these flyers and I got mobbed. I mean, people were saying that's impossible. And I explained in a nutshell what I just explained here. And they said, what can we do about it? I go, spread the word. So that's because we tried with the U.S. government, our target audience, there's 2 billion Muslims in the world. And we believe that they would love to hear what we have to say. And that's who we're targeting. We're trying to get the word out. Well, we want to get it out to everybody, but in particular, the Muslim community. Because it's so large, because next to the next of kin, no one's been more harmed by the lies of 9/11 than the 2 billion Muslims in the world with Islamophobia flourishing and everything. So they've been wrongfully persecuted for crimes that Muslims did not commit.
Yeah. And so many of us bought into this. I mean, certainly in my normie days, which went on for a long time after 9/11, whenever I got on an aircraft, I would be studying my fellow passengers. And if I saw some Muslims, you know, obvious Muslims getting on, I'd be thinking, oh,
yeah, right.
I don't want to be on a plane with these people. Why aren't they being chucked off? Which is how it works, isn't it? The part of the rationale, if you can call it that, behind 9/11 was to demonize Muslims and
right.
create this division, yet another divide and rule division in the world between
right.
Muslims and the rest of us.
Exactly.
But I thought, Dan, that kind of everyone in the Islamic world knew it was an inside job anyway. Was it really a surprise to those people outside the mosque?
No, it was a surprise. I was there distributing this literature saying what I did. I go, you can't say this. I go, yeah, because the other thing I was trying to get in to see the Prime Minister, Imran Khan. I was using back channels to do it. I was within a couple of weeks of doing it before he was ousted. But I had to go through his military secretary to do it. They called me one day, asked me what I wanted to talk to him about, and I told them they never got back to me. So I went with a letter to the Inter Services Intelligence Agency, the Director General, saying, hey, look, we've got this wealth of information out here, not just our group, but others. And I'd like to share it with you because it impacts Pakistan and Muslims, okay? Because Pakistan lost 70,000 lives through the war on terror. And I thought for sure they'd like to know this information. So sure enough, on March 7th, 2022, I was invited to ISI headquarters and I briefed a colonel for about an hour on everything I knew, including the uninterrupted autopilot. And he said, look, the director general wants to meet you. We're going to bring you back in. He couldn't be here today. We're going to sign a film crew to you to do a documentary. And then the next month, Imran Khan was ousted. And that ended my plan there because it's been political turmoil ever since. But the information they had, you would think a Muslim country, it's the second most densely populated Muslim country in the world, you'd think they'd jump on this information. But the problem is Pakistan's a debt slave to the IMF. And they're heavily dependent upon the U.S. for aid and trade, and they don't want to buy.
Yes.
So they can't.
And also, the ISI is so compromised. I mean, I imagine that the Americans are all over it. The British intelligence are all over it.
I knew that before I went in there, Jane.
Yes, of course you did. There must be goody factions though within it. I bet there are some decent people.
I don't want to get in the current political situation here because the ISI is listening to this broadcast right now.
Of course they are. I do get the feeling that Imran Khan was a goody.
Oh, he was.
He's a goody.
He was the best thing that ever happened to Pakistan since Muhammad Ali Jinnah. I mean, he's got like an 80% approval rating here still, but there's a news blackout that's preventing anything from getting out of the country. So I'm already telling you more than I wanted, James.
Yeah, no. Well, okay, we'll move away from that. But I just want to go back to what happened to you when you started asking inconvenient questions. You lost your job.
Right.
But it was worse than that, wasn't it? You also lost your pension and everything. Tell me what happened.
Well, they pulled me out of schedule like I told you they did. Wouldn't let me bring my attorney in because the union said they couldn't represent me because they were on the ropes about to go face down because United Airlines was in post 9/11 chapter 11 bankruptcy, right? So we were at an impasse when my chief pilot called me and said, look, I got to put you on sick list. I go, well, this is punitive. Well, one thing led to it. I was going to go non-pay, and I called him one day, and I said, what's up? Well, the union lawyers had already warned me that if they couldn't get me professionally or medically, they'd go after me psychologically or otherwise to get rid of me. And they told me, we've seen this happen before, Dan. You're never going to fly another United Airlines airplane again in your life. So what I did, backing up, was I created a tremendous correspondence trail, recorded phone calls, got witnesses, even went, hired the best psychologist and psychiatrist I could find in Atlanta where I was living at the time, saying, here's where I am, here's what they're going to do to me, prove I'm mentally stable, which they did. We got it all on paper. So he said to me, Dan, all you have to do is submit to the employee assistance program, go up, see a doctor up in Chicago, it'll keep your pay coming in, it's endorsed by the FAA, the company, and the union. And we'll fly you up there first class, and it won't take long at all. Well, I went up there and suspecting everything along the way. And long story short, they did have me see a psychiatrist. I told them, yeah, I have seen mental. They asked me, have you seen mental health professionals? I go, sure, you want to talk to one? I pull out my cell phone. And I go, Dr. Moe, this is Dr. McGovern. He wants to talk to you. So he told him, yeah, he's mentally stable. But he said, would you be willing to go over and see our psychiatrist? I go, sure. I knew you were going to say this. So I went over there. Long story short, they claimed I was bipolar, which was a joke. I know what that is, right? I even chuckled when she said it. And I said, look, I have two mental health professionals in Atlanta that will beg to differ on your diagnosis here. I'll take it up with them, thinking naively that the system wasn't totally corrupt. Because I spent the next 5 years of my life banging on doors, writing letters, emails, phone calls to every relevant level and branch of the U.S. government. To no avail. But getting back to what it did to my family, there's more to why my wife of 27 years divorced me. It wasn't like we were cheating or anything else, but I got into another whistleblower dilemma involving the mom, and she was afraid. But because of that, a 27-year marriage was destroyed, and it alienated my two kids, who weren't that old at the time, and blamed me for the divorce. They still think I'm a whacked out conspiracy nut and don't talk to me, which hurts me greatly. That was my biggest loss. And I had destroyed a 35-year career in aviation and my reputation as a pilot. And I lost about $4 million in pay, pension, and stock, all for just being honest. So I worked with the National Whistleblower Center and Government Accountability Project in Washington for a while. And they're the two biggest whistleblower advocacy groups in the world. And they told me late in the ball game, Dan, federal whistleblowers in the United States stand less than a 2% probability of winning their case. The system's rigged against you. You're not going to win. So my advice is blow the whistle, but be careful how you do it.
How have you survived financially in those years since?
on a meager pension on my Social Security. I make enough to get by, but it was a big drop from what I was making to where I am now. I'm 75 years old and don't need to be doing what I'm doing, but I know too much about the lies of 9/11 to remain silent, so I won't.
Well, I salute your courage, and I'm so sorry that you've suffered so much. I mean, lots of people in what you might call the truth community have suffered in different ways, and they've experienced to a greater or lesser degree what you've experienced, which is loved ones not going with you, just refusing to accept your that you're speaking in good faith, and that you just haven't gone mad. But I find it hard to rationalize. Okay, so your kids were young at the time,
right?
But how, since they cannot have looked into what you're saying to see whether there's any merit in it. I mean, surely
they won't even they won't even talk to me about it. They won't even answer emails or phone calls, so I can't discuss it. What I did do was write a book. It's still with the editor right now. It's called Grounded, Memoir of a 9/11 Pilot Whistleblower, and it tells my whole life story, at least starting from when I was a kid forward in the aviation arena, and what actually happened to me. And I wrote it for them. It really started out as a manuscript, and an author in Chicago and Nashville came to me and said, isn't it about time you write a book? And he co-authored it with me. But my sole purpose for writing it was hopefully my kids would read it before or after I'm dead to see what exactly it is, what I was doing. And the other thing our group has done is we produced a documentary. It's called 9/11, The Advent of the Ninth Crusade. And you can access that on our website on the drop-down menu. But it in part goes into what happened to me. But again, they probably won't watch the documentary.
It's so sad. I can almost see what's going to happen. They're going to, you know, when you're gone, they're going to realize too late.
Yeah.
Oh, that's really horrid. I'm sorry, but loads of people have experienced this, and this is how the world is. World is a dark place. Can I ask you, not related to 9/11, there was recently a Boeing whistleblower case where a guy working for Boeing was testifying in court about problems at Boeing.
Right.
And then 3 days into the hearing, mysteriously committed suicide.
Yeah, he was suicided. Yeah.
What was he? What do you know about him?
I think that he was working. He was like that 32-year Boeing employee, 62 years old, and I think he was working in quality assurance at the airline and recognized that the quality of work had decreased substantially. And he had testified once and was going to go in and testify, I think, the next day before the shooting occurred. And it wasn't. They said apparent self-inflicted wounds. And Boeing offered their condolences. Yeah.
That's nice of them.
Yeah.
I think he was talking about the Dreamliner, wasn't he?
Oh, yeah, you might have been right. I read the article the other day, and I don't remember all the details.
So I'm thinking, I mean, what's the word on the street among pilots about the Dreamliner? It doesn't sound like it's a plane you want to be flying in.
Yeah, it's a lot of Boeing problems right now at United Airlines and elsewhere. I just read one recently. I can't remember what it was now, but yeah, the airlines are experiencing problems out there, and it's raising a lot of eyebrows amongst the traveling public, saying, what the heck's going on here?
Do you share my suspicions that that is rather the point? They're trying to stop people flying. They're going to bring down a few planes to frighten people even more.
That's possible. I had a guy on Twitter come to me and ask me, hey, he goes, I'm already afraid of flying. What's going on? And I said to him, don't be too alarmed, because the fact of the matter is the airlines will go out of their way to cover up any kind of an incident or accident that occurs out there. I was involved in a nose gear up landing years ago at O'Hare, and they whisked us off the airplane over to a private hotel, said, don't answer your phone, don't talk to the media, don't do anything. So I saw firsthand how they cover up incidents like this. So I just think somehow these things are being leaked to the media, that it's not too extraordinary the number of incidents that are occurring.
You're not really reassuring me, Dan. I mean, now I know that they can just hijack any plane they want by remote control. Now that I know that there were these safety issues, and I know that they don't want us to fly, I'm linking it all together, and I'm thinking, well, what are they going to do next?
Yeah, right. Well, I'm convinced that the same people that ordered the 9/11 hit are the same people that are in the Ukraine and Gaza right now.
Yeah. I think that's, for those of us who think we understand how the world works, I think that's that's a given.
Yeah.
I've got to ask you, because I ask all flying people, what do you know about chemtrails?
I haven't studied. People are always asking me about that in Flat Earth. And I haven't studied.
Yeah, I've got to ask you about that as well.
Okay. Well, I haven't studied chemtrails enough to make an educated comment about it. I always thought it was condensation trails from moisture in the field that crystallizes when it hits the very cold temperatures up there.
That's the cover story.
Yeah, that's the cover story. But I really can't comment on it, James, because I don't know enough to. But as far as Flat Earth, I nonstop get asked, is the Earth flat? And I said, well, technically speaking, I believe it's an oblate spheroid. But no, I've been up at very high, the highest altitude I ever flew an airplane was 43,000 feet. And you can just barely discern the curvature of the Earth at that altitude. And that's what I've told them. Tell them is I've just seen the curvature of the Earth. And they go, well, don't you have to make corrections for the curvature of the Earth with the nose of the airplane as the curvature occurs? I go, no. Airplanes fly at a constant pressure altitude, which they don't understand. I'll send them some links to some information on it, but they've got some pretty wild ideas that it's convinced them that the Earth is flat.
It sounds to me like the jury's still out there, Dan, because I'm not listening to your testimony and thinking either way.
So you're a flat earther?
No, I'm not. I'm bi-curious.
Yeah.
You know, the thing is, Dan, you must have found this. Once you realize that everything they tell us is a lie, pretty much.
Right.
It means that everything you thought you knew about the world is up for grabs.
Right.
And I've heard some compelling theories. I mean, I'm trying to get a flat earther on the podcast, but I haven't done it yet.
Yeah.
But anyway, I don't like drawing people out of their field of expertise.
Yeah.
And your main one is the 9/11 thing. How do you go down in Pakistan? Are you popular in the local community with your crazy theories?
No. As a matter of fact, next month I'm going down to Lahore. We've created a PowerPoint presentation I'm going to give to a group of people. I tried one over at the Pakistan Airline Pilots Association in Karachi last year, and it was a flop because only about 10 people showed up. But the guy that's putting this together says he can put 100 people in a room, and I just want to sample the water and see how receptive they are to what I have to say.
And this is just my idle curiosity. I've never been to Pakistan. I'd like to go because, I mean, there are parts of it which are incredibly beautiful, aren't they?
Yeah, in the Swat, northern region.
Yeah, how do you find life there?
I thought people would hate Americans when I came over here. Nothing could be further from the truth because I'm warmly embraced in that regard. They don't care too much about U.S. foreign policy, but Americans they love. And it's a very poor country. 40% lives below the poverty line at 40% illiteracy rate. So that for me is depressing because you have beggars coming up the window of the car with naked babies they're holding it with their hand out going, please. So
yeah.
That's depressing. But there are beautiful parts of the country, and the people are nice, and I enjoy the food and the culture and all. So,
Yeah, I mean, I imagine curry every day. That sounds a treat to me. I'd love that. Yeah, excellent. Well, Dan, I hope I haven't missed out any key questions that I should have been asking you. Have I missed anything?
No, you've been a very good host. If I could just mention a couple things here. I told you about the documentary, but I'm on Twitter at Dan Hanley 4. If you want to join me there, follow me there, or if you want to communicate with me, just drop me a message that way. And I'm on Facebook at Dan Hanley. And I think that's about all I had. James, you've been very good in your questioning and leading me down different roads, but thank you very much for having me on the program.
No, it's been a pleasure. Now tell us once again where we can find your website.
At 911pilots.org. And we've got a YouTube channel at 911 Pilots that has about 57 videos on it. Some of them are interviews of me like this, but we have other interesting videos on there as well. But don't walk away saying the guy's crazy, thinking that airplanes can be remotely controlled. If you go to the website 911pilots.org, read it. It's a pretty easy read. Watch the videos there. We are convinced you'll walk away, and I have people come to me and say, "You convinced me after reading your website." So just go there and read, and you'll see how the pilot, those hijackers, couldn't have flown the airplane, and about this system.
You strike me down as like many airline pilots I've met as very, very level-headed. You kind of need to be in order to do the job that you do. So thank you very much, and thank you for your courage in kind of ruining your life to get the truth out. Thank you for the work you're doing. It only remains for me to thank my lovely viewers and listeners. If you like this podcast and you want to get early access to my stuff, which tends to get released about a week early to subscribers. Support me on Substack, on Locals, on Patreon, Subscribestar. If you want to just buy me a coffee, buy me a coffee. That's great too. I really appreciate your support. Support my sponsors. They're helping me. They produce. They've got good product. I wouldn't have them on the podcast if they didn't. And keep listening. And thank you for watching. Thanks a lot again, Captain Dan Hanley, retired.
Thank you, Jane. Bye-bye.